This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:03. It's great to have you with us for the Tuesday edition of the Noon Business Hour as market action is underway again after the holiday. I'm Cisco Cotto. We have lots of clouds in Chicagoland. It's going to get warm, though, and maybe some sunshine later on today. The Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. On today's Noon Business Hour, also Travel Tuesday, how Hurricane Dorian may be affecting your travel plans no matter where you are heading around the country. Also, a look at how Chicago's casinos may impact some of the big names. The government employment report for August, due Friday. We'll preview that in our next segment. Right now, though, the U.S.-China tariff roller coaster continues. While there's data on manufacturing and construction out today, that's certainly impacting the markets. We're joined by Andrew Bush, editor of the Bush Update at andrewbush.com, based here in Chicago. China-U.S. tariff war roller coaster, Andy. That's a pretty good way to describe it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it just keeps rolling along. Obviously, we have people coming back from vacation and recognizing that nothing's changed, and actually things have gotten worse. Cisco, one thing that I dug up over the weekend was that by the end of this year, the tariffs that the U.S. are placing on Chinese goods will reach 24.3% as a tariff. And these were just at 3.1% at the beginning of the Trump administration. And about 70% of Chinese goods coming into the country will have tariffs. U.S. has almost all of our goods that are going to China right now with tariffs. And you can see by the ISM data, the manufacturing data, not only here in the United States, but globally, everything's softening up.
Well, talk about that a little bit, because I think at first when all of this started, it was a little easier for some people in the business community, some investors, and even consumers to go along with it. But now it's having a real world impact here.
Yeah, and I think myself included, you know, as an economist, we look at these things and you try to estimate, well, how long is this going to go on? And the longer it rolls, the worse it gets and the more impact it has on the economy. And you can see, look at any of these graphs for these global manufacturing indexes, and you can just see that they're just slowly eroding away. And what's interesting today is with the U.S. Data from the ISM, I mean, so many categories fell. Not only did the overall index fall below 50, which is the contraction, but export orders fell to 43, which is down about four points. Jobs fell about 3 points or 4.3 points to 47.4. New orders, 47.2. These are all in contractionary areas. And then you just might as well toss in, let's just, you know, pile on here. Consumer confidence fell. U.S. small business confidence fell. Big drop in truck production. Big drop in Japanese capital expenditures. Big drop in the Chinese yuan and currency. So the only thing that I'm telling people that is going to go up soon is unemployment.
Well, so, I mean, China, they're seeing all those same numbers. They're hearing the analysis. They have economists. What incentive is there for the Chinese to actually strike a deal that gives the U.S. anything if they think that maybe we're going to cave soon because of this data?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a great question. I mean, their data, as far as their GDP, everybody's starting to ratchet back. And for China, this is a slow number, but it's below 6 for next year. And probably below 5.5 at some point this year if this continues to go on for the rest of the year. So as far as the Chinese go, they don't, you know, they probably don't look at it that way. They probably go, we can wait this out. We can wait Trump out. If there's another president that comes in that is more to our liking, maybe we won't have this tariff war. But right now, the Chinese are definitely hurting. So it's really a question of, can the Chinese continue to stimulate their economy to get around this while they wait out the president?
Always good insight. Thank you, Andrew Bush, editor of the Bush Update at andrewbush.com. The Labor Department will issue its employment report for August on Friday. Let's discuss what's expected. Richard DeKayser joins us, economist at Wells Fargo, based in Washington, D.C. That's our first question. What do we expect out of this report on Friday?
Well, you know, I just crunched the numbers myself, and I expect an increase of 175,000. The consensus is a little bit lower at 150,000. And I would say if we get anything in the ballpark of either of those numbers, that would be relatively placating. So let me give you a little bit of context. I came in on the last conversation we were having about China. Clearly, the trade war and its repercussions are the number one issue in the short term as we look ahead over the balance of the year. We have evidence, clear evidence, that businesses are playing defense. They're retrenching. They're being very cautious with respect to investment activity, whether it's inventories, capital goods, software, structures, whatever. The only thing that's really not turning south so far is the labor market. Now, businesses will trim employment if they feel truly threatened, profits are in jeopardy, and uncertainty is elevated. And we haven't seen that yet, and that's critically important. That's what's keeping the economy going. The consumer sector has been very strong. So bottom line is if we get something in the vicinity of 150,000, 175,000, I think that would be very encouraging news. The risk is if we see something significantly south of that, and, of course, time will tell.
And is that really the big thing, time? Because if you have manufacturing contracting, it'll take maybe a little while, but at some point there'll start to be cutbacks.
Well, yeah, and also I think it's important to recognize that this whole tariff war is still relatively fresh and vintage. You know, it started last year, but it was really quite small, things like washing machines and solar panels. Back in February of 2018, and then even the middle of the summer of 2018, we saw a slight escalation. But it really is just since May of this year, that's just a few months ago, that we've seen the big ratcheting upward vis-a-vis China. And, you know, literally September 1st, just this week, we saw further escalation. We've got more coming in October, more coming in December. It's still early innings in terms of the whole repercussions of the trade war. So when you mention the issue of timing, it would be premature even to draw any kind of firm conclusion from a single month's evidence. What we're seeing is really the repercussions unfolding over a period of months, and the fourth quarter will be critically important.
When it comes to cutting employees, will it be interesting to see if there's patience on the part of especially larger businesses? A lot of them would probably agree that there does need to be a change in how China does business with U.S. companies. But when it comes time to actually every quarter, you got to report earnings and Wall Street's watching.
Well, that's right. That's right. So a couple comments. First of all, before we see any cuts in employment, I think we'll see diminished hiring. You trim back on hiring before you see cuts. And we have seen a little evidence of that. But you're right on the second point about simply business sentiments about China is that they feel fair trade is more important. And this is especially critical in the industries of the future where intellectual property are paramount. Unfortunately, what we've done to date hasn't really targeted those critical sectors. It's sort of a broad brush approach, everything from sneakers to, U.S. soy exports being affected by China retaliation and the like. So it's kind of been a scattershot. You know, if we roll back the clock 2 years ago, Chinese demand for many of these products were absolutely, soy in particular, was absolutely enormous. I mean, China was importing more than any other country or any other five countries combined. But that retaliation is really only come in since the trade war began. That was not a pre-existing condition, if you will. That's part of the whole conflict that's now been underway.
Thanks so much for the analysis, Richard DeKayser, an economist at Wells Fargo. Up next, sometimes people dump stocks in September. Historically, it's not such a great month, but why you shouldn't do that.
Conversation that's on the money. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
September is historically the worst month for the stock market. However, there may be reasons to weather the storm. Let's get some insight from Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com, based in Washington, D.C. Mark, before we find out why we maybe shouldn't dump the stocks, just kind of talk about some of the history. Is there just something about September where markets tend to dip?
Well, I guess that the answer is yes, though no one knows why. But if you just go back and look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average back to when it was created in the late 1800s, September very consistently has been one of the worst performers of the entire calendar. I think its average return is like 1% down, which is statistically quite a big difference from the average gain that exists for each of the other months. So it's really quite a distinct difference. But as I say, there is no no reason that anyone that I know of has been able to come up with that explains why it should be. And since the markets are filled with these kind of apparent statistical correlations that have no that make no sense, that end up not being ones you should bet on, I'd say probably it's too risky to go ahead and bet on it for this September, even though the record looks pretty good.
Yeah, so what is it about this September that makes you say maybe people shouldn't do that?
Well, I have written about this, of course, for a number of years. Every beginning of September, I turn to my readers on MarketWatch and I say, give me all the explanations that you've heard for why September should be a bad one. And I, in fact, in the column on the site today, I go through each one of the reasons that I've been given, and it turns out none of them holds water. I go through and shoot holes in each one of them. It's it reminds me like when I read children's stories to my girls. I'll read the Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories, like the story of how the leopard got his spots or something. It's one of these stories that we chuckle about when we read to our kids. But these stories that people come up with for why the stock market does something oftentimes has no more credibility than a Just So story about the leopard. And it's one of those things that's, I think, quite amazing that when we want to believe something, we will believe it, even when even a very slight amount of statistical scrutiny would show you that it doesn't hold water.
Now, when it comes to something like, say, for example, you're talking about third quarter earnings, in general, it's not a good idea to be juggling your portfolio around based on what you expect out of one quarter.
Well, that's right. I mean, indeed, what you're mentioning is that one of the standard explanations that I got when I polled my clients was that people in September are worried about what third quarter earnings will be, which of course are announced in October. But of course, as soon as you think about it, why shouldn't they be worried about first quarter, second quarter, or fourth quarter earnings as well? And it turns out that's the sort of thing that as soon as you just step back, just one step and say, hey, does that really make a lot of sense? It turns out that it falls apart. And the reason that you shouldn't bet on something unless you can come up with a good story for it that has, you know, it has some at least plausibility, is there are lots and lots of examples where there are things that look to be incredibly correlated that aren't. My favorite example is where a guy went through an encyclopedia of data from the World Bank and found that the data around the world, one data series that had the best record predicting the S&P 500 was butter production in Bangladesh. Well, no one would ever think that Bangladeshi butter production has anything to do with the S&P 500, but yet, from a purely statistical point of view, it looked overwhelming.
Thank you so much. Always good insight. Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for The Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Cisco Cotto. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. American and United Airlines have taken Boeing's grounded 737 MAX off their schedules into December. We'll update the struggle for recertification and travel Tuesday. We'll also measure the impact of Hurricane Dorian on air passengers. A casino in Boston could be a good model for a similar facility in Chicago. Chicago Public Schools open for a new academic year under the cloud of a possible teacher's strike. On Wall Street, the Dow down 357 points. The NASDAQ is down 95. The S&P down 26. And oil today is down just under 3%. Lots of clouds in Chicagoland. Some lingering rain showers south of the city and into northwest Indiana. We'll get some sunshine later this afternoon. High of 84 degrees. Right now, 71 O'Hare, 72 degrees along Chicago's lakefront. Hurricane Dorian could cause a gasoline crisis in Florida. Let's find out whether the ripple effect might reach the Chicago area. We welcome Patrick DeHaan, senior petroleum analyst at GasBuddy.com here in Chicago. Patrick, is there a chance that what happens down there could affect us here?
Well, thankfully not at all. This is not going to be a pricing event. In fact, not even a pricing event in the Southeast. Prices have not been impacted. Average gas prices here in Chicagoland continue to slip. Average prices now across the area, $2.92 a gallon. It's about a dime lower than where we were a year ago, and now about 25 cents lower than a month ago.
So is it something that normally a hurricane doesn't really have an impact, or does it just seem like in this situation not much is happening?
It certainly does vary storm to storm. You can have a storm 2 years ago, of course, Hurricane Harvey, which did impact refineries. That's the wild card. Dorian is not impacting any refineries throughout the area, so there's no impact to gasoline production. So supply is continuing to flow, and that's the biggest thing. No price impact, as there's no hit to supply.
So, you know, another note here, the taxes here in Illinois and expected gas prices to be way high for a while when those went into effect. Just yesterday, I think I found it for $2.55 in some of the suburbs yesterday. So really seeing gas prices, I guess, pretty stable, really not that bad.
That's right. Even with the tax increase, we're still lower than a year ago. But if you look at what the national average is compared to a year ago, there's quite a bit more difference. National average last year was 282 on this date. Now is 256. That's part of the reason why Chicago and Illinois prices are a little bit closer to last year, of course, because that big gas tax increase that took effect July 1st. But as you mentioned, oil prices down today. There was actually some news that OPEC increased production from some of the countries, Iraq and Nigeria, and that may provide more relief for motorists in the months ahead.
Thanks for all the information. Patrick DeHaan, Senior Petroleum Analyst at GasBuddy.com, joining us here on News Radio. Stocks are lower today. Let's find out what's going on. Susan Schmidt is joining us, Head of U.S. Equities at Aviva Investors here in Chicago. Susan, pretty much down all around, about 1% or more on the major indexes. What do you think of what's going on here?
Well, down all around, and the market is back from summer holiday. Kids are back in school. Everyone is focused back at work. And I think people are really taking some negative takeaways from concern over trade, rhetoric that this concern and volatility around trade is going to continue, and as well as the ISM data. So Institute for Supply Management releases data, and that number came out and indicated that things are slowing. So the market's definitely moving to a risk-off position. We're seeing that with weakness in a lot of the cyclical stocks, and I think people are taking that in stride and saying we've got a lot of, once again, global noise that's to the negative, and we're taking some risk off the table.
The Noon Business Hour presented by the Village of Bedford Park. Susan, a lot of analysts, I'm sure you would be in this category, would say don't emotionally invest. Look at the numbers, see the trends. However, with all this volatility and the day-to-day roller coaster, sort of tough not to let emotion get into it.
It's really hard to keep emotion out of it. And in fact, that day-to-day volatility is reflecting some of that emotion as it goes into the market. Remember that markets don't like to be surprised, so you typically do see a knee-jerk reaction when there is a big surprise. I think right now the important thing is to look to the long haul here. We are going to have a lot of volatility. And remember that we are now really in an election cycle. Once again, we're going to start hearing sound bites. We're going to hear about global positioning, whether as it relates to trade with China, but also remember we have things going on in Europe. So with negative news regarding Brexit today, we do have these sound bites that are going to hit us out of the blue that are going to cause those negative emotional reactions. It's going to lead to volatility. Recognize that things with this ISM number indicate that, yes, things might be slowing, but there are still good companies to invest in. This is when it's really hard to time in the short term. You have to look to the long term.
So give us maybe sector-wise, in a volatile environment, so much uncertainty with China and Brexit, are there certain sectors that people should look to during a time like this?
Well, we are seeing people shy away from the sectors that are going to be most impacted by concerns around trade, and we're seeing that with weakness in industrials, weakness in financials. We're seeing concern about the yield curve as rates come down. And so we have that people, when they want to go risk off, run towards things that are perceived safety, and that's utilities, REITs, staples. And so you can position for that, but recognize that you're also potentially missing opportunity if you run to safety. If you can have that long-term perspective, you might be able to find something that's better value if you're willing to wait it out. But it is going to be tricky, no question about it, because the sound bites don't depend right now on the underlying business fundamentals. They really are coming from exogenous events.
Yeah, really very interesting times. Thank you, Susan. Always appreciate you being on the show. Susan Schmidt, Head of U.S. Equities at Aviva Investors. Up next, Travel Tuesday, updating Hurricane Dorian's potential effect on the airlines in your travel, no matter where you're headed.
Loaning useful information each weekday.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Travel Tuesday here on the Noon Business Hour, sponsored by Hamilton County Tourism. This afternoon, we're updating the status of the Boeing 737 MAX and looking at the impact on travel from Hurricane Dorian. We welcome back to the show Joe Schwederman, professor of public services and director of the Chaddock Institute at DePaul here in Chicago. Joe, let's begin with Hurricane Dorian. When an event like this happens, whether it just hits Florida or sort of moves up the coast a little bit, there are ripple effects across the country.
Well, that's an understatement. I think what's remarkable about this is it's really the whole state of Florida, not just the Atlantic coast. Of course, it's working its way up in the Carolinas, and that's just a massive impact for the airlines. And about the only good news is we've had so much advance warning that people can adjust their plans.
And so, is those adjustments, though, it's really difficult to know exactly what the airlines are going to do, right, until everything's settled.
Well, this is really tricky for passengers because most airlines are, essentially saying you can rebook your flight. We're flexible about that. But you have to complete travel by a certain point. Like Delta's offering refunds toward a future flight, more flexible. But, if you say, I don't want to go to Florida in a week and a half, it's too chaotic down there. I want to, cancel it and maybe drive somewhere for a vacation. You're stuck having to rebook your ticket or you're going to lose your value. So it creates a lot of dilemmas for people who, really aren't interested in rescheduling. They want to go now or not at all, and that's going to evoke some pain.
And I'm wondering, I have some people's stories that I have heard of people actually on cruises in the Caribbean who got an extra few days because of Dorian. Sometimes, I guess, it benefits you. You get a little bit more out of it.
Yeah, I think what you're going to find is actually getting out of Florida when the hurricane is over is not going to be that tough because so many trips have been canceled. The whole flow of people has been disrupted. The airline is going to fly people down there, and the people that would otherwise plan to return won't show up because their trips, their whole trip was canceled. So I think they'll be able to get back okay, but there's going to be some pain because there's going to be uncertainty when these flights are going to take off. You may have to go standby. It's nothing like this has occurred in the last few years where literally a whole state has been down for a better part of a half of a week.
Now, is something like this worse because of the troubles with Boeing 737 MAX and just fewer planes in circulation?
It is certainly adding to things, especially on American and Southwest, where load factors are just really, really high because they're consolidating people on flights, and it gives them a little fewer spares to sort of revamp, ramp up the operation. So that adds to the pain. I think, though, mostly here, this is a case of just passengers living with incredible uncertainty and scrambling. I mean, say you have a wedding in Florida and that's canceled, and now you have to reschedule your trip, and there's going to be a lot of requests for full refunds, and the airlines better be ready.
Sort of surprising to you at all that this has gone on this long and that Boeing wasn't able to get a fix sooner and get the planes up in the air?
It is. And we all thought when people said, Thanksgiving, we thought that was a reasonable thing. And I think the only good news we've had is airlines were united and others saying, we're planning on January now. Let's just be realistic. And now American today came out and said, we're going to have these flights up by Christmas. We're confident. And you would have thought Boeing stock might be getting a boost from that. But I think investors say, we've heard this before. Until something's tangible, we'll stay skeptical. So Boeing stock is down again today. I think, though, the worst-case scenario is off the table, and that's that when they start doing these fixes, they're going to find five more things wrong, and it's going to become a soap opera. That scenario has kind of disappeared. But the best scenario that, we're going to ramp these things up and have them in the air in November, That's a distant dream right now.
Yeah, sort of a wait-and-see approach for sure. Joe Schwederman, Professor of Public Services, Director of the Chaddock Institute at DePaul. This time tomorrow, Personal Finance Wednesday. Still to come, why a casino in Chicago would want to attract whales.
Cashing in with conversation. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
A new casino in Boston could be a guide to a successful gambling facility in Chicago. Let's learn how high rollers could be the key. Steve Strawler is a reporter for Crain's Chicago Business. He's written about this. Steve, thanks for being with us here on the Noon Business Hour. So what can Chicago learn? I guess give us some of the nuts and bolts of what they're doing in Boston.
Well, this is viewed as a prototype urban casino of the kind that Chicago might want to emulate when it finally gets one here. It's really oriented, unlike the casinos, the regional casinos and riverboats we know already here. This casino is oriented more toward the international tourist, and that's certainly something that Chicago is going to go after, even in spades, compared with any other new casino in the U.S. outside of Las Vegas.
Is that easier for Chicago? It may be like the East Coast because it just has so many tourists here, people in town for conventions, too.
Yes, conventions. This will be what is called an integrated resort that's combining a casino with resort-type facilities, which include conventions. And as you mentioned, Chicago is the premier convention town, and O'Hare Airport is right here, too.
And is that impact the location then, as Chicago still continues to wrestle with where they're going to put this casino?
Yes, I do believe it will. It's got to be somewhere close to downtown, the Loop. Michael Reese, the former Michael Reese Hospital site has been mentioned. That's not far from McCormick Place. That could be a possibility.
Now, is this Boston situation making a lot of money? I mean, doing pretty well. And in that sense,
well,
has it become the model?
It just opened in June. So the first month's receipts were $50 million, which annualizes already to about $600 million. And that's more than any any casino in Illinois has produced in a year so far.
Yes.
So it's projected to rake in as much as $1 billion a year, and that's certainly something that Chicago would shoot for.
So you really have to make it a nice place then if you're looking for high rollers. Like you mentioned, the Boston one, pretty luxurious.
Yes, they've got what you would find in Vegas, a lot of VIP suites. Their standard hotel room is three times the size of the average in New England and so forth. Probably a lot of comp offers out there for high rollers to come in.
Interesting. Thank you. Steve Strawler is a reporter for Crain's Chicago Business, talking about what's going on in a Boston casino, how it may be a model for Chicago. Past programs later today, a podcast of this hour at WBBMNewsRadio.com and the radio.com app.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.